By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
Hello, and welcome to this year's first episode of Emerging Markets Decoded. My name is Scott Phillips, Head of Emerging Markets at Moody's Investor Service. I'm joined today by my colleague, Gene Fang from the Sovereign Team in Singapore. Welcome to the podcast, Gene.
Hi, Scott. It's nice to be here and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you too. So Gene, we've got you on today to talk about China. And throughout most of 2022, emerging market analysts watched on as the outlook for Chinese macroeconomic growth was consistently revised downward by forecasters, having started the year between 5 to 6%, but ending the year close to 3%. As we all know, China was hit by a double whammy of a crisis in the property sector, which saw several high-profile debt defaults, but also the impact of the authorities' strict COVID-19 lockdown measures. Now, for 2023, things are expected to be better. Now, we're forecasting GDP growth of around 4%. But many market participants are asking themselves whether we'll ever see the types of growth rates of old. 4%, is that the new normal? Or to put another way, are these lower rates part of a cyclical or structural trend? Now, this question, I guess, is even more pertinent since the government's partial reversal of its zero COVID strategy in December.
Now, the impact of China cannot be overstated. On its own, Chinese bond issuers account for a relatively modest portion of international investors' portfolio holdings. But for other emerging markets, China is a major driver of growth, trade, and investment. What happens in China matters for all emerging markets.
So, Gene, let's get right to it. At the end of last year, the Chinese authorities did seem to be shifting away from the zero COVID strategy. But when I look at our forecast, we're only expecting a sort of modest tick up of around 1% in GDP growth. So why are we not more positive for 2023?
Yeah, Scott. I mean, I think to be fair, our current forecasts do assume a change away from the zero COVID policy, and that change would happen in a way that allows consumption to rebound in the second half of 2023. So what we're seeing right now is broadly in line with those assumptions. And although the shift in policy has certainly started sooner than what we expected, I think what we're seeing now really is that bumpy transition period, and we think it will take some time for consumption to fully recover. So what we're watching right now is how the situation evolves. Obviously, the infection rates are peaking and cresting at different regions of the country at different points. And, you know, we're waiting for some of that to progress and go through while we see Chinese New Year period coming up. And that will give us an important indicator of how consumer confidence is evolving.
Okay. So, I mean, it sounds like there could be a positive surprise on that 4%, but obviously a lot of uncertainty, as you say, with things like, you know, the progression of COVID through the community and also the consumption patterns around the holiday period. And clearly there's, you know, big unknowns around that right now. But I guess, you know, coming back to the 4% growth assumption, you know, look how we're breaking that down. A lot of that is, I think, is predicated on, you know, expectations for higher infrastructure investment this year, right? Particularly by the regional and local governments, these RLGs, but also the local government financing vehicles, the LGFVs. So, Gene, talk us through, you know, how is all of this investment going to be financed? And what do you see the impact on credit risk for the RLGs?
Yeah, I think first off, I think you've sort of pointed at this already. A lot of the funding is going to be done through the regional and local government SOEs, and in particular the LGFVs that are a subset of that. And that's essentially going to be off balance sheet financing, and from a credit perspective, that implies a higher level of contingent liability risks for both the regional and local governments, as well as ultimately the central government in China, whom we expect to provide a lot of support for regional and local governments. And I think we do see a lot of the financing to be coming off balance sheet, because the on balance sheet part of the funding usually comes through the provincial and special purpose bond quotas. And we think these will be relatively moderate. And I think that's because the government is still taking a relatively cautious approach to direct leverage, though we will get a better indicator of how these quotas will be set following the two sessions when the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference meet in March. And then finally, I think land sales are going to be weak in 2023. And land sales have been an important source of funding for Chinese regional and local governments. And in fact, they started weakening in 2021 when the property sector started to come under stress. We expect that is going to continue through next year, along with the challenges facing the property sector. I think another interesting point to watch as well is going to be how differentiation evolves around regions in China. I think onshore, investors are looking much more favorably at provinces and regions that have stronger economic prospects. And the flip side to that is that, you know, regions with weaker economic prospects could face more challenges in terms of raising financing for LGFVs that may ultimately require, you know, higher level of central government transfers to those regions in order to make up the difference.
I mean, just listening to you there, though, I mean, you're talking about some things like, you know, widening fiscal deficits, given the lower levels of revenue from land sales, rising debt, you know, higher contingent liabilities. And you mentioned, obviously, you know, a lot of this financing is going to be off balance sheet. I mean, is this a sustainable model, do you think? I mean, do you think there are, you know, kind of credit pressures building that we need to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I think the credit pressures definitely are building, but we've maintained a stable outlook on China's sovereign rating for a couple of reasons. First of all, at around 50% of GDP, China's direct general government debt exposure remains relatively modest compared to A-rated peers. And as I mentioned earlier, we do think the debt quotas allowed by the central government this year will continue to be relatively modest. And I think that reflects the government's desire to prevent leverage from really getting out of hand. Secondly, for the off-balance sheet part, while we do think contingent liabilities will grow further, China does have some capacity to limit the systemic impact of these risks. And I think that comes from the Chinese government still retaining a high degree of control over the financial system. That's through the state-owned banks, and also through its control of large parts of the economy through the SOEs. And that ultimately helps the government direct support and relief in a way that prevents systemic risks from really getting out of control. So even though we might see more isolated credit events around some regional SOEs or even LGFVs, the risk of this getting out of hand is somewhat limited by the government's extensive control over the economy. And then finally, I think growth will continue to be relatively robust for China. It will be higher for China in 2023 than what we saw in 2022. And I think China is one of the few economies globally where we actually expect growth to accelerate in 2023. And of course, a more sustained recovery could be achieved if we see consumption rebounding even stronger than what we expect. And that would obviously contribute to more revenue, helping to manage some of those fiscal deficits you talked about earlier.
Yeah. No, I think you make a good point there around, you know, kind of higher growth. I mean, and how China is a bit of an outlier there compared to a number of other emerging markets. I mean, when people look at kind of the overall number for emerging market growth in 2023, yes, it's higher than 2022. And that gap to kind of more advanced economies is starting to widen up again. But it's important to bear in mind that a lot of that's coming from China, right? So a number of the other countries that we've got in our kind of coverage are expected to post weaker levels of growth in 2023 compared to last year. So let's kind of break that down a little bit, Gene. I mean, at the beginning, we talked about how important, you know, China is in terms of its import for raw materials, where a lot of that kind of comes from other emerging markets. So, you know, kind of given our 4% growth assumption and the environment more generally, you know, what do you think import demand for raw materials, for commodities, for China is going to look like this year?
Well, since our base case suggests a recovery in China, I think this is going to be broadly supportive for commodities exporters, particularly those in emerging Asia. And, you know, for example, for Indonesia in 2023, we think growth is going to be relatively stable from 4.8%, just down slightly from 5%. And I think China's recovery certainly contributes to that. I think the impact will be even more pronounced on Mongolia, for example, where we expect growth to recover to 5% from only 2.5% in 2022, given the heavy concentration of exports for Mongolia into China. At the same time, a prolonged slowdown would have the opposite effect, with much more negative repercussions for exporters like Mongolia. But Mongolia is not the only one. Australia, though not an emerging market, does have a relatively high dependence of in terms of commodity exports on China. China accounts for nearly 80% of Australia's iron ore exports. So more broadly speaking, we do think that those negative repercussions would be there for commodity exporters in emerging markets, including LATAM and Africa, in the event of a more prolonged slowdown in China's economy.
Okay. And what about Chinese property then, right? I mean, that's been a big hot topic for international investors last year. You know, as we said at the beginning, we've seen a number of defaults. As you said at the beginning, you know, we're expecting property sales to be down again 10-15% this year, particularly acute, I guess, in some of the less developed regions and provinces. So I guess the question from my mind is, you know, have we seen the worst of this crisis? You know, is the market stabilizing now, do you think?
Yeah, I think given our sales expectations that you just mentioned in terms of property, it will remain a very challenging year for the property sector in 2023. Although there are some signs that the government wants to sort of contain further downward pressure in the property market, and that's mostly by ensuring liquidity and funding for developers, just to make sure that developers with projects underway can continue to get financing for those. And that was signaled through China's 16-point plan supporting the property sector that was announced in November, also further endorsed in December's Central Economic Work Conference. At the same time, I think the support overall is going to be limited. The aim here is really to sort of contain some of the risks from spreading further into other parts of the financial system and the economy overall. But I think the more fundamental objective from the central government's perspective of reducing the size of the property sector is still very much in place.
Okay, so Gene, just to sort of finish things up then, I mean, I did mention at the start that, you know, I think a key question for investors this year is going to be whether the growth dynamics we're seeing in China now are cyclical or structural in nature. But I guess one thing that's always surprised me, you know, following China for a number of years, is the, you know, capacity to positively surprise, right? You know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, maybe some of the negative things. We talked about how growth is going to be still higher, but obviously lower than historical trends. So, you know, to try and answer that question, what do you think are really the top two or three things that we should be paying close attention to as we kind of start the year?
Yeah, Scott, I think the first thing we're going to be looking at is really around how consumption begins to recover in this new, you know, post-zero COVID world. And I think we'll begin to see indicators of that, as I mentioned, around Chinese New Year. And I think that's going to be important in terms of showing us the direction and really the pace at which consumer sentiment may start to recover. Secondly, the two sessions in March will be very important. We always see a lot of important policy announcements in coming out of the two sessions, and in particular, specifics on economic and fiscal policy will be really important to us in terms of telling us how the government wants to balance between promoting growth on the one hand and maintaining a degree of financial stability by limiting leverage on the other hand. And then finally, we'll continue to monitor trends in the property sector. And, you know, on the one hand, there are certainly downside risks that remain. And in the near term, that could have a very important impact on how growth ends up in China next year. But I think just as importantly, how the property sector emerges from this period of high pressure will be very informative to how we see, you know, the structural impact and the structural features of China's economy going forward. Property has played a huge role in the economy in the past. The government's intent is to basically reduce that role. What that economy looks like, if that, you know, reduction is successful, is going to be very telling in terms of how we see growth trending for China in the medium to long term.
Yeah, Gene, that's awesome. That's a really good summary. I mean, maybe just I could pick up on the last point there. I mean, you talked about, you know, downside risks and what that means for growth. I mean, talk us through what does that scenario look like in your view?
I guess if the scenarios that we're trying to think through are whether or not a reduced contribution from the property sector is offset by more government investment in infrastructure, for example. And I think we've talked about, you know, the credit impacts from that investment in infrastructure, or whether, on the other hand, there will be other sources of growth and productivity growth in particular, which will take the place of property going forward. And I think that is probably one of the key questions we're trying to ascertain for ourselves when we think about not just the trends for 2023, but you know, really the medium to longer term beyond that.
Okay, that makes sense. So there you go. There's our three things: Chinese New Year, what happens with consumption around then, the two sessions in March, and also the property sector. So thanks a lot, Gene. I mean, as ever, China is going to be a hot topic in 2023. Lots for us all to think about as we start the year. Thank you very much for coming onto the show today and sharing your insights with us. Join us next time for another edition of Emerging Markets Decoded. And in the meantime, if you have any questions or feedback for us, please feel free to email at empodcast@moodys.com. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this Moody's Talks podcast. To find out more about the topics discussed, please follow the links in the show notes. You can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts by visiting moodys.com/podcasts.